a most original and creative talent in our business. Would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles again, come to call for another visit.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
All right, well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. We are joined by our famous historian, Vincent. It's always great to have him here. We have Kathy Fuller Seeley, who is, of course, our Jack Benny specialist and also a historian. And we have Terry Phillips from Imagine Air Theater. Go check that out. We'll be presenting this week an actual one of his shows. He did a Western show for one of his, and we're going to present that one this week. So try and tune in and see when that is. I don't know when I'm going to air it, but we'll find sometime this week it'll show up. Anyway, we're on Orson Welles, and this is a really interesting Welles one. I believe this is the one with the sound quality where it's not nearly as good as our other ones. There's lots of sort of whooshing sounds throughout and sort of things. But it is listenable. I mean, there's no real issues. Certainly other old-time radio I've heard sounds way worse than this. This is just not up to our usual ultra-high standards. Last week's episode, I was listening to that as I was presenting it, and I was just like, oh, wow, this is just like he's in the room with me. It was so clear. But anyway, so today's episode, we have an Orson who is really wiped out. You can totally tell that he's dragging. He's doing this, but he just had the opening for his show, and Vincent will probably go on more into that. But he covers so much ground so quick. This is probably the fastest and the most ground I've ever seen him cover. I really feel like, as I was listening to this, like we could essentially present a minute of it and we could talk for 5 or 10 minutes about that minute. And then we could go to the next minute and we could talk about 5 or 10 minutes about that minute. I mean, it's just so much information. It's like but this is unfortunately one of those episodes where if you're a person that just kind of likes Orson and his storytelling, you might be kind of overwhelmed at the amount of information he covers. Cause even I really get into it and I really like how when he covers lots of ground like this, but even I was getting lost and he was going so fast and talking about so many names and so much stuff going on. And at the time it was kind of hard to follow. So hopefully we can pull out little bits and pieces of it give you something to focus on a little bit in this. So we'll see how that goes. So Vincent, why don't you start us out with whatever stuck out for you? Well, you can tell us, we'd love to know a little bit more about the show that he's talking about that he's done. And then on top of that, anything that stuck out for you in the episode.
Yeah, absolutely. First, I want to just sort of corroborate what you're saying about how difficult this was to follow. As I was prepping for this, I was listening to it and I had to constantly pause and go back. And my wife was listening with me and she says, I just can't listen to this anymore. You just keep pausing and going back and pausing and going back. So it's naturally going to be hard for listeners to follow. I mean, the first thing that you do need to know is, you know, he is exhausted and he's exhausted primarily because of Around the World. And to call Around the World a train wreck at this point is really an understatement. First of all, because there's an actual train wreck that they stage on stage with like a giant treadmill. This production was huge. I mean, I have some sort of quick facts here. It required 55 stagehands, 9 boxcars of settings, costumes, actors. It had livestock. It had 32 elaborate sets. It had movies, circus, life-size paper mache elephant. I mean, I could go on, really. I mean, this was a massive thing, and coordinating it was difficult. And this actually plagued Around the World for its entire career, or its entire run, because when they would go into a new city, in this case, they just went into Boston, they opened late, they couldn't get everything going, it would go terrible. And then it would kind of work out for a little bit. They figure out in Boston, and then next episode, they're going to be finishing up in Boston and going to New Haven as they're building their tryout. And so it kept going terribly. And unfortunately, reviewers almost always come to the first show. And so just to give people a sense of why Welles is so sort of disturbed on how things went is because, you know, the press sort of ate him up. I mean, I'll read this one for you guys. This is a really good one. So this is from the Boston Herald. They said the kitchen sink may have been missing, though I wouldn't be too sure, but nothing else was. For Mr. Wells's prodigal imagination matched, it would appear, with an inexhaustible bank account, has turned out a production of such size, variety, and such up and downs of quality that is staggering to contemplate and by no means simple to describe. And then he goes on to talk about all the depressing things that were in it and how it was sort of botchy. And then another person, I'll just sort of summarize the review. This is from Peggy Doyle. And she essentially says, lots of shows end up sort of being terrible at their beginning and they work their way up to Broadway. She says, there's no way that Wells is going to pull this together. And you can see sort of, again, why he's exhausted. Because it's not going well, basically. Too big.
Too big. Wow.
Wow. It makes me wonder if it sounds like the kind of thing that only really could have been pulled off by like one of the Disney stage productions or either doing Phantom of the Opera or Lion King, kind of that level of spectacle. But even that wouldn't have the movies and the.
It's true. I mean, it's a multimedia show before that's really, really that common. I mean, you know, you have at one point there's a life-size eagle that literally picks up the main character and throws him around the stage without, you know, he literally has to grab on and hold on. There's sort of like this little harness thing, but it is. Spider-Man one that was plagued on Broadway maybe like 6 years ago and they had to close it early. It reminds me of that. Definitely. Wow.
But this is what happens when you have, as he's always called, a genius, a wunderkind.
Yep.
You know, this is what happens when someone who has such grandiose ideas and who pulled them off successfully, Citizen Kane and many other productions. Right. But when it goes bad, it's spectacularly bad.
Well, and even when it goes well, it scares people that are financing and help. It's like, seriously, you need more money. You need more everything. And I'm sure everybody's by the nails going, if it goes successfully enough that they get their money back, they're like, okay, but I never want to do that again. And so I think he burns through people probably with the way he approaches things. And then if it goes bad, then you've lost money and you've felt like a nervous wreck for 6 months. And so,
Daryl, doesn't it remind you of the Stan Freberg radio promotional sketch about, you know, we'll take this giant maraschino cherry and drop it in the middle of the Grand Canyon? Well, you can do that on the radio.
Exactly. Well, maybe that's why Orson found so much success on the radio and struggled some other places.
Yeah.
You could have the giant budget or the supposed giant budget.
But in a way, that very comment of the things you could do on the radio ties then to also, I think we were sort of let in this episode to a tiny shred of Orson's mind that when he's talking about all the different current events going on, that he's just, you know, he's just a stew of anxiety. And I'm guessing that maybe when you caught him in a mood like this, this would what it would be like sitting listening to him. He'd be pulling from this and that and the other, the entire newspaper is worth of you know, anxiety and things going on. But to then the dramatic bit to say, little child, hold my hand and I'm going to lead you through this. But as I said, I was really caught by, oh my God, this is so much everything that's scary and going on and terrible about 1946. Again, as opposite from we've won the war, we should be going to Disney World, to starving children in Europe and people living in garbage dumps and nobody can afford anything and car prices are going to go through the roof and you can't afford a suit and you're
agreed. Well, and I think, I don't know if he was ever officially diagnosed with anything, but I figure he's got something going on because this certainly seemed like a manic episode that he was having where he was just throwing, really moving. And
people speculate on that all the time. Yeah, I mean, that's very common in biographies. And he had really dark periods where he would just be held up in, you know, in a room and people would say, you know, Wells is sick. or, you know, this is normal dark times and things like that. So I think you're totally right on. And you see that. I mean, even for somebody who's having a manic episode to pull it together, I think even that we can understand about stand it and talk about it is impressive. Yeah. But it's nonetheless, the wheels are overdrive.
Well, Terry, what were your thoughts on there? What stood out to you on this one? That anything?
Well, I thought for the sake of our listeners who might not know the alphabet soup and the some of the names that he refers to, I'd just quickly go through those.
That'd be wonderful.
OPA, of course, is the Office of Price Administration. It was a wartime creation to prevent inflation. And for the most part, it was successful, but it was highly controversial. And as Wells pointed out, there were lots of efforts to undermine it and block it. And it finally went away after the war in 1947 and was subsumed by other agencies. But OPA is what he referred to, as it was commonly referred to. He mentioned three names who were used by FDR as kind of symbolic of the anti-Roosevelt, anti-administration efforts. They were Martin, Barton, and Fish, and they're interesting guys. Martin was Joseph Martin, who was a Republican congressman. He was kind of the Kevin McCarthy of his day. He was minority leader for a while. He was Speaker of the House, and he was very involved in the most provocative aspects of politics of the day. The thing that people most remember about Martin is that in 1951, when he was minority leader, he got on the floor of the House and he read a letter that had been written to him by General Douglas MacArthur. And it was in response to an inquiry that he made about the war in Korea. Now, this letter was intended to be private, only for Martin. But Martin, who was, as I say, provocative, controversial congressman, decided to read it for the entire House and ultimately, since it was covered by the press, for the world. And it was the letter in which MacArthur criticized Truman's handling of the war in Korea. And it led to, I think about a week later, to Truman firing General MacArthur. Yeah. So it had kind of the opposite effect that Martin had intended. Barton was another conservative politician and an advertising man, one of the founders of BBDO. He was the Barton in Batten, Barton, Dunstein, and Osborne. And again, a controversial man in his own time. He was involved in a sex scandal while this is before Congress, I think, or maybe after, but while he was not in office, but while he was at the ad agency. There was a woman who was working at the agency who made, as the accounts of the day put it, made herself available, even though she was married. And so I don't know who on the staff had relations with her, but at least a couple did. And they ended up paying her, as it was described at the time, hush money, not to actually not for her husband, not to to sue them. And she was greedy.
We call that a non-disclosure now.
And that's correct. but she got greedy. $25,000 wasn't enough money for her. So she said, I've written a book and I won't publish it if you give me another $50,000 or $100,000. And so they sued her for blackmail and they were successful. Wow. So that put a stop to that. And finally, the Fish in Martin, Barton, and Fish was Hamilton Fish III, who was, again, another right-wing congressman, a Nazi sympathizer, and the father of Hamilton Fish IV, who became famous for both being one of the first Republicans to vote to impeach Richard Nixon, and who ran successfully in 1968, defeating G. Gordon Liddy in his bid for Congress.
Wow.
So Wells says the new Martin, Barton, and Fish is Gossett, Walcott, and Crawford. And again, these are the names of three congressmen, Ed Gossett, a Democrat from Texas, Jesse Walcott from Michigan, and Fred Crawford, also those last two Republicans from Michigan. But, you know, kind of clever uses of names. Yes. Martin, Barton, and Fish made me think of Abraham, Martin, and John, even though it had nothing in common with the title of the song. But, you know, these were the kinds of wordplay that politicians at the time engaged in a rather sophisticated use of language that's kind of lost in our time, I would say.
Well, and it reminds me when you say all these names again, back to Stan Freberg, his ad agency that's in the history of the United States of America or whatever, the Osborne, somebody, and he goes through all of it.
Yeah.
Well, there's a Jack Benny connection too, because it was the first time on the Benny radio show that they started mentioning the ad agency. They'd never mentioned Young and Rubicam, but it became people in the ad world commented that when Mary Livingston said Batten, Barton, Durston, and Osborne, that it sounded like a box rolling down a set of staircases. But then, of course, they switched it to Dear Little Old Mr. Osborne. And for a while, his secretary showed up and was flirting with Jack Benny. So there, we even have a Benny connection. So.
That's great. All right. Well, is there anything else for this one? Because I think we've probably gone about long enough for this intro, and then we'll do another one. So, all right. We'll end this. Good luck making it through this one. It's fun just to hear him so, like I say, manic and so out of it. And just, it's somebody that just sounds like they haven't gotten a lot of sleep lately and is just kind of trying to get the thing done. And of course, whereas others of us would underdo it, when he's in this mode, he overdoes it. And that's kind of stereotypical of him, that he kind of overdoes everything. And so, well, you get this incredibly packed commentary. So enjoy it, and we'll see you next time for a little bit calmer commentary, I think. A little.
This is Orson Welles speaking, and this is Sunday morning, 1 week after Easter, 1 year after the end of the war in Europe, and it's also, inconsequentially enough, the morning after the opening in Boston of the show the Mercury Theater hopes to bring successfully to New York. Here's some notes I made on the back of an envelope. Do you remember that pigeon catcher I told you about last week? Well, I brought it out on the stage last night, but I didn't catch any pigeons. Some more notes. We all remember Martin, Barton, and Fish. Here's a new one, a new firm to remember, the firm of Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford. Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford dropped the atom bomb on OPA. If prices get all tangled up in the tail of an inflation kite, remember Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford. If your savings dwindle, if they're cut in half, remember Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford. If the landlord wants more rent, if the price of meat goes beyond your budget and the cost of a suit of clothes keeps you in patches, remember Gossip, Wolcott, and Crawford. Ladies and gentlemen, here's a play producer who also speaks, as he's trying to now, over the radio for a quarter of an hour each Sunday morning. He's healthy and strong, just healthy enough to get to the Boston radio station the morning after a Boston opening, and just strong enough to get to the microphone. He's a play producer who's supposed to comment on the large affairs of the world, who tries to speak up bravely in behalf of the future. Well, last night he left the theater, he rented for his play, and walked through the side streets back to his hotel like a man wanted by the police. The most ordinary, cheerful Saturday night pedestrian crowd looked like a lynch mob to this producer of plays, who locked the door of his room when he heard a siren somewhere outside and really thought for a minute as he stood there, bolting himself in, "They've come after me." Here's a play producer who woke up after a night of delirium, fully dressed, on the top of his bed where he had fallen, exhausted, fully dressed, but not too sure of his right mind. A play producer with a normally loud voice who's called so long and urgently for curtains and cues in the past 7 days of rehearsals that he's almost lost his voice along with his mind. Here, in a word, is a play producer. He's full of his own woes and the woes of the small army, a very nice and really wonderful people who are working so hard for him and depending on him to get them safely to Broadway. A play producer with a ringing headache and a hoarse voice. His problems have no call upon your attention, and of all the citizens in Boston town this morning, he's one of the least equipped to hold your interest on a national hookup for 15 minutes on national affairs. He hereby fulfills his engagement with his apologies. And since he's at it, he'd like to include here apologies to the audience last night who waited through so many stage waits, who watched so many of the wrong backdrops moving up and down with the solemn rhythms of bedlam, who had no way of hearing in that bedlam some of the greatest songs one of the greatest songwriters ever wrote, who could not have picked out of that chaos much of the talent that tried so hard to make itself seen and heard. He hopes to make it all up to all those people Monday night. And meanwhile, on Sunday morning, 1 week after Easter, 1 year after the end of war in Europe, and the morning after a very hectic opening, that's about all the comment this commentator has to offer. Members of the audience of the Boston Opera House, members of the Mercury Theater, and listeners to this radio program, believe me, he is always and as ever your obedient servant. Yes, this is Orson Welles, and please take my hand. Let me take yours. I have my troubles, but it says in the papers you've got yours, too. Let's hang on tight so neither one of us gets lost. Here in Boston, where the hatred of tyranny is a matter of record and tradition, here in Liberty's home address, there's been terrific resentment against the congressional action on OPA. On the commons stand women with breast banners and placards bearing the words, Save OPA. Protect yourself and your future. Boston's good people are signing petitions in the streets, and I hear from the Capitol that the congressional mail from everywhere is the heaviest in all Washington's history. In favor of continuation of OPA without crippling amendments, it's 10-1. A senator was heard to admit the other day that in his mail it's running 25-1. What are they saying in Congress? I give you Representative Hartley. They went too far, says Representative Hartley. Yes, the boys went too far, and Representative Hartley was one of the boys. That pink look on the face on the congressional floor was pretty general and chronic these last few days. Oh, yes, the representatives who let themselves be counted on the side of economic disaster have been worried more than some, as Mr. Runyon puts it, and busy, no little, answering mail. Mail from their constituents, and some fun that was, too. Here's a letter on a congressman's desk. Dear Mr. Congressman, says the letter, why did you vote for the amendments which will cripple the OPA and make its very existence impossible? Here's the congressman's answer. Dear Mr. Constituent, you are laboring under a misapprehension. I voted for OPA, not against it. There were some changes, of course, but I voted for it. Maybe one of your letters has reached a congressman's desk, and maybe it got one of those answers. To such an answer, the only possible acknowledgement is the horse laugh, loud and clear. Loud and clear, the congressmen are squeaking up now in defense of OPA. They put their foot in it, marched right into a political booby trap. Now they're calling for help. The congressman wanted us to know they were for it all along. Of course they were. They put OPA in a box and stuck swords in it. If it was any kind of a trick at all, it was a dirty trick, a devil's trick. If it was done with mirrors, the tricksters found reflected in the glass only the grimacing blind face of their own political greed. Have you forgotten the shanty towns that grew up in our city dumps not long ago, the communities built of cardboard, the residential districts developed by human ingenuity out of garbage? Maybe you've forgotten them, but you'll get a chance to see them again if that House bill gets to be a law. Fantastic? Fantastic? Disaster is only plausible when it happens to the other fellow. That's the cellophane wrapping of human optimism. That's what keeps us sane. The train wreck with its 40 dead is credible on the front page as long as a name of a loved one is not printed in black on the death list. The fall of Guernica was a fact the folks in Galveston could accept. The Battle of Britain made terrible headlines in Butte, Montana, in Bangor, and in Beverly Hills. Still, the buzz bombs didn't keep us from finishing breakfast, but Pearl Harbor was fantastic. Reading about the Blitz was like reading the statistics on cancer. We were moved, but not so moved that we sought refuge in doubt. Pearl Harbor was something else again. Thousands of grown-up citizens who knew a good deal about Ethiopia and Manchuria, who'd been following the fall of Europe like a serial, called up the radio stations on the morning of 1 December 7th and wanted to know if that Wells fellow wasn't putting on another Martian scare. So, if I tell you that there are shanty towns in Chungking, you'll believe me, and if I tell you inflation, more than Jap bombs, made those shanty towns, you'll believe me. And if I tell you that inflation is going to bring more shanty towns, you'll still believe me, as long as we're talking about China. Suppose we go then into the realm of fantasy by talking about home. I think you'll believe me then, too. Hang on to my hand so neither one of us gets lost. Let's go now for a little look at commercial rents. Yes, just look at them. Commercial rents are the rents paid for offices and stores and garages, things like that, which are not controlled by OPA. Not controlled by OPA because your Congress refused to extend to your lawyer, your doctor, your dentist, your insurance man, so on and so forth, the same protection you have on dwellings. In Washington, D.C., just for instance, where that refusal was perpetrated and solemnized, commercial rents have zoomed as high as 500%. 500%. In terms of a roof over your head, that is fairly fantastic.
But if that House bill gets to be a law, we'd all better get used to that kind of fantasy. I have a bad headache this morning. I'm full of personal weariness and general despair and aspirin, but you'll have to take my word for it that I'd feel just as badly if all the scenery in our show last night had moved on schedule. The audience in the Boston Opera House had lingered for hours to applaud our efforts to the echo. I'd still be full of weariness and despair and aspirin. The crippling amendments on the House bill for extending OPA are worse than all the missed and messed up cues any play producer ever had to pay for. Me, I'm living in the theater these days, and before a New York opening, a theater is a queer sort of atoll, cut off from the world by reefs of rehearsals, not to be approached by land or sea or air. But on the call board, the stage door, the kids, the overworked kids in our company, are putting up their names on a petition against that OPA House bill. They have time enough for that. And at intervals throughout the day and night, they bring me the newspaper and a hamburger, a donut, or a carton of drugstore coffee, and that's how I eat, and that's how I know the news, the newspaper. Hang on to my hand. Let me hang on to yours so neither one of us gets lost. We'll stop at this booth for a minute, an agricultural exhibit. The tableau represents the farmer's future under inflation. Under inflation, farmers will put their grain into cattle because stock prices will soar. To give you an idea how tired I am, there's quite a difference. In the next booth, we have a tableau of starving children. Might be our children, except that they happen to be born on the continent of Europe. Their little eyes are huge with hunger. Patient observers report that these children are never seen to smile. And these children are expected to grow up somehow and somehow to build with us a free world. In their present condition, they don't look much like founding fathers of a European democracy. In point of fact, if we don't get food to them, these little children will starve to death. If our farmers are forced by inflation to put their grain into cattle, we won't have any food to send to them. I'd say goodbye to the little children now and go on to the next booth. But why go on? You're ahead of me, way ahead of me. Hold on to my hand. All this mail deluging the desks of the congressmen may have really shaken deeply the very roots of their misbehavior. The word from Washington this morning is that OPA has a chance to live, or maybe I'm too tired to know what I'm talking about. But take my hand and I'll take yours. That way we won't get lost. I seem to sense something peculiar and very new in the air. Call it, if you will, an atmosphere. The youngest generation may not recognize it. Teenagers may not even know what it means unless they've read their history books with the most careful study. As I remember, it used to be called an era of good feeling. Another sign that an era of good feeling may be setting in is the news that Mr. Bilbo went home. The man Bilbo, who threatened to filibuster until the end of the year against the British loan, suddenly packed up and drove home to Mississippi. Peckerwoods, said Mr. Bilbo. More Peckerwoods are gnawing away at his chances of re-election. So, after only a 2-day filibuster, which for Mr. Bilbo is just time enough for a senator to clear his throat, he went home. Could be that the people of Mississippi are wising up to the wreckers of goodwill. On this weary, woeful morning, I smell hope. And I'm sure of this much, the chances of the British loan have increased, and by a healthy percentage. This Sunday morning, 1 week after Easter, 1 year after the end of the war in Europe, there are some hopeful signs observed by your tired commentator that the tired diplomats have found a modus vivendi, a way of getting along together. From Paris, there comes to a strange sound, strange indeed, and strangely, they don't get headlines smeared in big black block letters. The little one-column banners may read, Big Four Reach Agreement on Italian Peace Treaty. But, you know, if I were editing the papers, I'd use big black block letters and underline it with big black block editorials, because, you know, this may really be the end of war. Foreign ministers were grim and grave when they gathered in Paris. They were ready for failure. Jimmy Burns had even gone so far as to whisper to a group of Washington newspaper men in the shrillest confidence that there was every likelihood that no peace treaties would ever be signed as a result of World War II. Our Secretary of State said rather that each of the big four powers might have to sign separate peace treaties, and that this, of course, would mean no peace at all. I talked to somebody on the phone in Washington yesterday who told me that the day before the Paris conference opened, Mr. Burns told the French foreign minister that the United States would not even insist on France being given the right to sit in on all the peace treaties. Burns saying that he felt the Russians would oppose this, Burns being too tired to make a fight. But when the foreign ministers sat down at the conference table in Paris Thursday, even the gloomiest of the Cassandras were confounded. The Russians surprised us again. The Russians readily agreed to permitting France to sit at the peace table as full and equal partners. In one short hour, the agenda was agreed to. Mr. Molotov turned out to be as cordial as could be, and Mr. Bevan was flabbergasted. The troublesome Italian issue was put at the top of the list, and this was the same treaty the deputies of the foreign minister has been calling over for a month. In four brief hours, three of the knottiest questions had been solved, and the reparations argument was cleared up in 20 minutes, including time out for the translation. People who sometimes know the answers tell me that the Russians have taken other steps to solve differences between the East and West. And so the atmosphere in front of the footlights and behind the scenes for the first time since victory is that of a United Nations. I've kept insisting I'm a very tired play producer. I may be tired. I may be so tired I don't know what I'm talking about. And this cheerful claim of mine may blow up in my face tomorrow. But like the man says, there's good news tonight. I'm never sure of anything. I'm not that kind of a commentator or that kind of a play producer. My voice is hoarse and my head aches, but I'm not speaking this morning at the funeral of OPA or of the United Nations or of my show. I'm still speaking in behalf of the future, and I'm very much inclined to feel okay about it. And though I'm full of aspirin, I'm still full of hope. Let's keep holding hands. That way we won't be lost.
The American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations have brought you the personal and individual news commentary of Orson Welles. Be sure to listen again over many of these same stations next Sunday at this same time to Orson Welles' Almanac. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.